From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. Dan Raviv, Senior Washington Correspondent for I-24 News. And our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us. And here are the issues. The coronavirus continues to spread. When will it be brought under control and at what cost? Here in the United States, Democrats clash at another debate. President Donald Trump picks a new intelligence chief amid warnings that Russia is again trying to interfere in America's November election. The president also issued some pardons of some big name white collar criminals. Well, let's start with this coronavirus. The epicenter, of course, is China, but the fear spreads far beyond that, of course. And this is more than a health story. This is an economic story. It has slowed China's economy, the global supply chain that is connected to it. It's also a political story, and we'll start with you, Dan. The political story being Xi Jinping's ability or inability to control what appears to be a growing internal crisis.
Well, as we see an example of how the world is more connected than ever, so many economies are affected by what has happened in China, coronavirus now occurring also in other countries, the number of deaths mounting every day. Sure, there's a question about Xi Jinping and whether he can administer an extremely huge and complicated country and how that affects all of us, because this past week, I was hearing for the first time from U.S. officials that they don't trust the numbers and the facts that are being issued by the Chinese government. Early in this health crisis, U.S. officials were saying, well, China seems to be more transparent than in the past. We like that. We can use this information. And among other things, it's led to confusion and fear because there's almost the assumption that if you have someone who's been in Wuhan, China, or has had contact with people who had been in Wuhan, where this coronavirus began, and then you put them in a quarantine for 14 days, that's sufficient. You'll be able to see whether they are ill or not. But there's so many reports of people who are carrying the virus who don't present with the illness. There are also reports that 14 days aren't enough. Obviously, there are so many questions. And one big industry that's been incredibly affected is travel, whether it's hotels, airlines, or cruise ships. There are people, even here in the United States, who are reluctant to book any foreign travel. Just in a few months, I would say the whole tone of travel and trust has changed.
Even Apple, the big computer software company, warning about, you know, its products and whether it can get
in two directions. They may have trouble getting the components from China, but also Apple and other big companies like to sell in China, and stores often are closed.
Now, JJ, out of all of these angles here, the economy, Xi Jinping's ability to control events, what sort of stands out for you?
Well, what stands out to me is that the model for determining who has coronavirus has changed for the third time. So this suggests, as Dan was alluding to, there is some concern about whether Xi has been able to do what he's supposed to do or should be doing to contain it and to deal with it. But one of his problems is not knowing enough about it. There are some serious concerns about underreporting in places in China. But what I've learned from a security point of view, and this is a specific military issue, Korea has changed their risk pattern or level right now to moderate. And essentially what they've done is put in place some very serious precautions to prevent people from leaving bases, people who can get onto bases. There are some close to 30,000 people in U.S. service members in South Korea, but there is a place called Daegu, which is one of these special hot zones that they believe that someone called a super spreader actually went to a church there and has infected many people who in turn infected others. So the U.S. military in South Korea is very much under the impression that if they don't get this dealt with and make sure that people are isolated from it, that it could spread into the military, into their families, and then cause a serious readiness problem for them.
Well, the question before we move on then, I'm not sure it's answerable, but when is this going to be brought under control?
It could take months even to find out whether the pace of the spread of coronavirus can be slowed down. Isolation and quarantines, that's a major step. Meanwhile, drug companies and also government laboratories in several countries are working on this virus to find a retrovirus, some kind of drug that works against it. So far, they don't have it. Now, not everybody dies. The death rate is rather high for a virus. 2% of people who get it have been dying. At least that's according to numbers that are basically coming from China. So again, U.S. officials aren't sure whether to trust it, but they say that's a high death rate, but especially older people. If you're over the age of 75 and you have it, then it's really hard even for a hospital to stabilize you. That's what's all very frightening. One other factor is that as the weather becomes warmer in the Northern Hemisphere in a few months from now, then almost always a virus will subside. But there's a fear that if they don't come up with some solution, that if the labs don't come up with a vaccine or at the very least a treatment, it would come back this coming winter.
So we're in a race against time, it would seem. Well, let's shift to the United States now, where, of course, the presidential election now just 8.5 months away. And the question is, who will the Democrats nominate to take on President Trump? There was a big debate this week, the leading candidates clashing, including the newest entry into the race, this mega billionaire Michael Bloomberg. But the front runner, JJ, is still this self-described Democratic socialist, whatever that means, by the name of Bernie Sanders. Your thoughts on the state of the race at this point?
Well, it is infantile, to say the least, at some points, when you look at some of the things that are taking place, some of the shouting and some of the finger-pointing and are you calling me this and are you saying that to me, the name-calling, all of that. But when you look at it, it's a very serious situation that the rest of the world is watching. And a part of why they're watching it so carefully is they're trying to figure out if the Democrats are going to keep their eyes on what's really important. And that is security, economy, health, and all of that before it's too late. The problem is, as each one of these debates come along and it's spent with people pointing fingers and shouting at each other, which people watching this and people who are critics and maybe people of other parties are hoping they'll continue to do that. The question is, the people need to figure out who is the best candidate. And so far, all they've pretty much heard is what each candidate can't do. So that's a real problem right now.
Here's one reason that Donald Trump is optimistic that he's going to win in November, another four-year term, because by definition, the Democrats are divided, right? Right now, there are six leading candidates still in the race, and of course they're divided. And Bernie Sanders, he is a Democratic Socialist senator. He says that some socialism would be good for this country, especially what he calls Medicare for All, kind of a National Health Service. He, in fact, would want to do away with private health insurance. Some other candidates say, well, we could have a mix, including, again, the young newcomer, a former mayor, Pete Buttigieg. He says he'd like to offer Medicare for All as an option, but don't do away with private health insurance or the health insurance that's been arranged by labor unions. That's just some flavor of the content. But this past week, when there was a debate in Nevada before the caucuses in that state, world affairs weren't mentioned at all. There was nothing on foreign policy. How would you handle Russia or China? There was nothing on the coronavirus, by the way. And so that means that the Democratic Party right now is still having its debates about, well, personalities.
Yeah.
Who's stronger, who isn't, as a candidate who can go up against Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the president is doing his thing, and that's good for him, looking like a leader. A lot of people don't like the president. Of course, a lot of people in this country do, but he's doing his thing and having several rallies every week. And by the way, Trump's rallies are bigger than anything that any Democrat can muster right now.
And if you look at the polling numbers, his numbers, it's good timing for him because all of a sudden with election, again, 8.5 months away, his numbers are not spectacular, but nevertheless, they're the highest they've ever been.
Well, they've recovered, yes.
They've recovered.
The approval rating, though, is 50%, so we still have a divided America that only about half of America thinks he does a good job. And some of the opinion polls are called head-to-head. What if it was former Vice President Joe Biden against Trump? What if it was the billionaire Michael Bloomberg?
But
and there it's very close.
Who do you think that Trump would like to run against?
Bernie Sanders. I mean, I think he wants to run against Bernie Sanders.
He thinks he can crush a socialist because Donald Trump thinks America doesn't want socialism.
Right.
I agree. And the one they fear, by the way, is Michael Bloomberg, another rich man from New York, where I've definitely picked up from Trump officials. They're very annoyed by Bloomberg spending so far more than $400 million on advertising, a lot of it knocking President Trump. That's annoyed the White House political
And a part of the reason, really quickly, about why he wants to run against Bernie Sanders, most likely, I'm pretty sure you probably have heard that commercial on the radio where he says America will never be a socialist country. This is Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, saying that. So it's very clear he would love the opportunity to run against Bernie Sanders. But I did see, I thought, that there may be some problems for him in Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Oh, there are some states that Donald Trump in 2016 won by a small margin where Democrats have reasons to hope that it'll go the other way. Just change one or two states and the Democrat could win this November. But let's not forget, we don't know who the Democrat will be, so it's very hard to predict.
Well, the thing about Sanders is if you've got a pretty good economy, it's not spectacular, but it's okay. Incomes are rising, not spectacularly, but they're moving up. Unemployment is quite low. People seem to be more content than they've been in a while, certainly since the Great Recession of a decade ago. That's going to make Sanders' argument that we need to veer sharply to the left. Who's going to buy the argument that we need to make these radical changes right now when things are going pretty well?
Well, our audience around the world may not be surprised that Bernie Sanders, though he's in his late 70s, he's a hit with young people.
Yeah.
And people can vote in this country starting at age 18. And young people, of course, want that kind of change. And for many of them, socialism sounds good, sharing everything. That's where he's a hit. You asked who would like him? Not perhaps the middle-class American who feels the economy's doing okay. Though again, the word on the street often when you talk to Americans is, yeah, the economy's doing well, but I'm not sure about the president and his behavior and his tweets and his, you know, erratic decision-making. And so it's very much a mixed picture.
Well, in any case, we've got Nevada, as you say, then big primary in South Carolina. Joe Biden, who is still in the race, but fading. He used to be Trump's biggest worry, perhaps not anymore if you look at
I think Trump just believes Biden's
tweets.
Strength is fading, so the White House isn't that worried about Biden. But Biden has hopes for South Carolina.
Right.
We really have to point very quickly to March 3rd.
We're just going to get to that Super Tuesday, it's called. Explain to our listeners around the world, what is Super Tuesday?
14 states on the same date are having their primary election. And that means that well over one-third of the delegates for the Democratic Party convention this summer will be chosen on that day, March 3rd, including our most populous state, California, having its primary. Yeah. March 3rd's really meaningful. I mean, a lot of people think that March 4th, we're going to know who's the Democratic Party candidate against Donald Trump.
Some people say it could go all the way to the convention this summer when they meet in Milwaukee, but Tuesday clearly.
Yeah, right. I think it depends on what happens on Super Tuesday.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now, back to our panel, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, Dan Raviv, Senior Washington Correspondent for I-24 News, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. Well, it's deja vu all over again. Reports that Russia is trying to interfere in America's election again and get President Trump reelected. At least that's the analysis of the U.S. intelligence community. And after it briefed members of Congress, President Trump reportedly angry about that, said he was replacing what's called his DNI, or Director of National Intelligence. JJ, give us the backstory here.
3 weeks ago, Shelby Pearson was at my studio doing my podcast, Target USA, and she talked about the threats that are facing the U.S. election as we work our way towards November. And she mentioned Russia, China, and Iran being significant threats and that they're watching them every day. She apparently gave a classified version of that to Congress. It was that briefing that some people on the Hill heard and got back to the president about it, told him what happened, and it angered him, according to the Washington Post and the New York Times and some other reporters. He blew his stack at Joe McGuire, who was supposed to be leaving anyway on the 11th of March from his acting role as DNI, Director of National Intelligence. But the president, according to these reporters, was furious that McGuire didn't stop that briefing by Shelby Pearson.
The reason could have been its content, saying that Russia and President Vladimir Putin are trying to help Donald Trump again, as U.S. intelligence.
Well, that's where I was going.
But Republicans, what did they really dislike about it? They claimed that it was shared with the Democrats who had impeached the president, who were after the president. In many ways, is it possible that the president is mainly angry that Adam Schiff, the Democrat, who's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, got this information and would be used against Trump? I mean, there might be something in that.
Well, should intelligence not be shared with the chairman of the Intelligence Committee?
Things are so divisive I can see that. Well, I mean, what, JJ, is that what you picked up?
Well,
that's what made the president angry?
That's the political part of it. The bottom line on what Pearson was telling them was that Russia is back. They're doing things differently. They've got a new playbook. They're still engaged in their primary objective, which is to make sure that a specific individual wins this election. And that individual apparently is the president, according to what these reporters have said. What the classified version said, we don't know. But based on what I've seen independently from Russian actors and people involved with Russia's intelligence, at least their digital footprint, seems to suggest they want this president to be president again. And I suspect that's what Pearson, in some way, alluded to, if not told the folks on the Hill. And by the way, she's pretty blunt spoken. So this may be a part of the issue.
Now, when the intelligence reportedly says they're trying to help him get reelected, what does help him mean? What specifically are they doing?
Well, they're doing the same thing they did with social media, but they're not trying to, for instance, pretend to be Americans like they were last time. What they're trying to do is to turn Americans against each other. They're still trying to fan the flames of issues. If you follow some of the Russian disinformation operations that are at play on the internet, you can see this happening. You can see situations where issues are being brought up by people that you wouldn't expect them to come from. There are actually people, physical people, that are at work in this country representing these elements of Russian intelligence that are fanning these flames. Many of these people are Americans. In the last time around, 2016, didn't know that they were being played. Some of them now, based on what I've seen, are willingly doing it.
So meantime, with Mr. McGuire on the way out, the president's new pick, Dan, is Richard Grenell, currently the ambassador to Germany. Controversial, some people say, and apparently intends to do both jobs, the director of national intelligence, which is a rather big job, 17 U.S. intelligence agencies. People think it's the CIA and the NSA, much more than that, 17 agencies, while continuing to be the ambassador to Germany. Tell us about Richard Grenell.
That seemed absurd when we first heard it. And within 24 hours, White House officials and Grenell himself said it's only for a short time. He'll be the acting director of national intelligence, and President Trump intends to nominate someone else. So they offered that bit of reassurance, but I think for a day or so, they really were thinking that. President Trump clearly wanted a loyalist. And Richard Grenell, the ambassador in Berlin, has been a Trump loyalist for a long time, very much a conservative Republican. He'd been a spokesman for various government agencies, but everyone knows, as a conservative Republican, he got this ambassadorship in Germany. He's quite outspoken there, too, among other things on gay rights. He's openly gay. And if he would become the DNI, he'd be the first openly gay member of a presidential cabinet ever in this country. So, you know, that's something notable. But above all, people said the president wants a loyalist. He's sick and tired of hearing conclusions of intelligence agencies that drive him nuts, that he disagrees with, that he thinks they're based on bias.
But here's the problem with that kind of thinking. I am not trying to equate this president with a Stalin regime or any Soviet regime or any of that, although there are some similarities. This was the main problem that Stalin had. He was a person who wanted to hear what he wanted to hear. And he went to significant lengths to make sure that his intelligence people told him what he wanted to hear. He's not the only one. There have been numerous people throughout history that have done that, that have massaged their intelligence so that it would work for their interest. This is the thing that the intelligence community is trying to warn the president about at this time. And I can tell you, based on talking with several folks in the intelligence community, several prominent people yesterday, words like alarm and words like being in a news void of information is something that they're experiencing. And this is a very difficult and a very serious time for them.
There's a discussion before we move on one American television channel this morning, and one of the phrases being bandied about was that the intelligence community is on the verge of melting down.
Yeah.
Rather dramatic.
Well, so let me just say this to you. It is as quiet as a mouse when you talk to the folks that you're supposed to talk to about what's happening, what's going on, because nobody wants to say anything because they're afraid to say anything because, you know, they may get in trouble. They may lose their jobs. I had an interview scheduled for this day with a very high-ranking member of the community, and that interview was canceled yesterday. And I'm assuming that one thing that we've been hearing all along is that people in the community are very, very concerned about what this president will do when he hears what they have to say. Speaking truth to power is very, very hard on a normal day, but today it's even more difficult.
We're going to be talking about this, I'm sure, in the weeks to come. But in our final minutes, the president has also issued some pardons of some big-name white-collar criminals. Dan, first of all, the term a pardon to our listeners, what does that mean exactly?
Well, here's an example. The president offered clemency, as it's called, which is a presidential power that can't be questioned, can't be reversed by Congress or the courts, to 11 people, 7 men and 4 women. Some of them, say Michael Milken, was convicted in the early 1990s. He served almost 2 years in prison and since then has become a very active philanthropist, especially on medical research. And so Milken has improved his image a lot since 1993, and now the president has pardoned him. In a sense, it expunges or erases the crime. But most legal experts say, by the way, if you accept a pardon, you are accepting that you were guilty of the crime. But you won't be punished again. Your record is clean. It's kind of an honor for a president to give you years later in recognition of something good that you've done since then. Rod Blagojevich, who had been the governor of Illinois.
And a Democrat.
Happens to be a Democrat. He also was favored by the president. They'd met over the years. And Blagojevich was imprisoned for, in effect, trying to sell a U.S. Senate seat that had been vacant. And Blagojevich was not pardoned. His sentence was commuted. It's another form of clemency, where he was allowed out early after serving 8 years. So sentence commuted, but the crime not erased or expunged.
So the guilty is still on his record.
It is. Again, okay. What's the difference? Okay. I mean, as we see it, these men and women got this big favor from President Trump, who clearly likes using this power, and it seems to be a preview that he may pardon other people in the news who are concerned with various Trump-related scandals.
Well, and some of those names, J.J., may include some big names who have either worked for the president directly or have been kind of longtime friends of his. Two names in particular that we're hearing, Michael Flynn, president's first national security advisor. He was on the job for about 3 weeks, I think. And also a longtime advisor named Roger Stone, who was convicted just this week of perjury and witness tampering. The president has already spoken out about that case, calling it a sham. What's going to happen to these two cases?
Very likely that they will go the way that these others have, getting a pardon from the president or something of that nature or clemency. You know, he said, seems to suggest that he's going to let the Roger Stone situation, quote, play out. And I think that probably means determining, first of all, whether he gets a new trial or not. But look, at the end of the day, here's what happens. After all of this is said and done, we still have to deal with the idea of running this country. And the people who actually run the country are not the president. The people who run the country are the people in the trenches every day. And a lot of the people in the trenches that I've been talking to are people in law enforcement, people in intelligence, people in the military. In their eyes, a lot of people that they hear from, specifically people from other countries, have questions about what we stand for.
We'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, J.J. Green, he's national correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. Also, Dan Raviv, he's with Israel's I-24 News. Thanks to both of you. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer, Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks for joining us.